Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Nick Hawthorne of Downing. So, big welcome, Nick.
Hi, Paul. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back after 12 months. Certainly, we've got a lot to talk about and catch up on. We've had, obviously, ongoing wars in Ukraine and the Middle East, and now we have a new chap in Downing Street, Andy Burnham. So, putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for equities over the next sort of 12 months?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, our view, certainly for UK small cap, is quite positive. So, you know, I think if we look at the UK as a whole, let me just turn off my Teams here. You know, if we look at, you know, UK as a whole, it's certainly, you know, significantly cheaper market, certainly than the US and elsewhere. So, you know, still on a 35% discount to the US. You know, small caps, again, you know, just within that mix, small caps are cheaper and that than large caps, and that's actually, you know, quite unusual. But again, we're looking at kind of 30% discount UK small caps versus large caps. And you know, I saw some nice data over the weekend, actually, looking
Nick
at the NS company index, going back to 1978, and they're looking at 5-year cycles. And you know, they took the UK market on a PE of today, 16, or UK small cap market 16 times, and you know, they're looking on that data, 5-year cycles, they're saying we should do 15% a year for the next 5 years. So, you know, that's good enough for me. You know, if we can do that, I will be, you know, a happy man, and I'm sure we all will be. I think it's that. Yep. I think it's that setup which is good. You know, we don't, you know, the UK is such a small market now compared to the US. We don't need a huge amount of capital to come out of the US into the UK to see, you know, some decent multiple expansion. And even then, you know, we'll still be a massive discount. So, yeah, you know, I think that's all quite positive. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, as I'm sure we all say, we do have lots of good companies here, and we've got them at fantastic valuations. And I think, you know, kind of the best evidence for that is the number of takeovers that we've got. And, you know, I don't know when people are going to kind of wake up and smell the coffee and say, actually, you know, I need to own some of these UK names. But, you know, if we're not going to do it, then other people will. So.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. I mean, the M&A spurge, we had one this morning with Time Finance as well. Bentley yep. Finance, I think, has bought it, which is a, sort of like a subprime B2B sort of lender. But if the forecasts are right and we do 15% per annum for the next 5 years, that would be doubling our money. So I would be absolutely delighted. One area that you've sort of tread carefully on, in fact, you've done very well to sort of miss it, has been that sort of consumer sector in the UK. Can you just talk why you've decided to sort of like underweight that area?
Yeah, I mean, we weren't so much. I mean, look, if we think back kind of a few years, we weren't intentionally underweight UK consumer per se, but we just thought that was a weaker place to be. You know, if we could get exposure to the US, for example, then that was a nicer place to be. Again, kind of UK consumer companies tend to be quite buy and build focused. And, you know, certainly in the past, we had been kind of less keen to own those types of names. I mean, we hadn't been, you know, not been completely ex-consumer. If we think, you know, think back to the webinar I did with you last year, I think one of, you know, my top pick for the year was Inspex. You know, that is, or was, or still is actually, since still listed, but that, you know, that was a consumer business, obviously in the eyewear space. And, you know, we did quite well out of that in the end. We used to own Loungers as well, which was obviously taken over. Also, I guess, kind of in that consumer kind of hospitality space. So, you know, it's not so much they're anti-consumer, but, you know, you got to pick the winners within that space. And obviously, you know, with headwinds to consumer spending in the UK, we just thought that was a, you know, a more difficult place to be. But, you know, it's all kind of valuation based. So, you know, if it gets cheap enough then for us, then certainly worth a look. And actually, you know, we we'll talk about it later, I'm sure, but we bought the gym, which we quite like. Yeah. You know, it's obviously main list, not AIM, but, you know, like that business, like that model, and see a kind of long pathway there. So, you know, kind of similar to Loungers actually, which ultimately was taken out. too early. But yeah.
Let's go to the gym, as we just mentioned it. Well, this is basically a low-cost gym operator in the UK, sort of like a bit of a no-frills, doesn't have swimming pools, but sort of I think it probably attracts a lot of Gen Z and younger oriented sort of people 24/7. It's quite a controversial stock because some of my fellow sort of professional retail investors don't like it because they claim that it doesn't make any money. But what's your take on it? What sort of attracted you to sort of the gym group?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you kind of gave a good overview there. Second largest low-cost gym in the UK behind Pure Gym. As you said, they're open 24 hours. There's no, you know, there's no saunas, no swimming pools, no tennis, no kids club. You know, it's just, you know, but well, bog standard gym, but you know, high quality gym and good equipment with a few classes, you know, will cost you, you know, depending where you go, but kind of 20, 22 quid a month. There's no lock-in, there's no joining fee, things like that. So as you said, it gets that Gen Z, Gen Alpha audience. And, you know, for them, fitness and health is now kind of a number one or two spend. So, you know, we like that. And then the other kind of dynamics in the market that we quite like, you know, the whole kind of gym fitness space is obviously expanding and low cost gym is taking share within that. And then again, if we look at other kind of developed Western nations, UK low cost is actually still significantly behind where they are. So we see, you know, good opportunity for UK to close the gap versus other places and also low cost to take more share within the total market. So yeah, that's all quite positive. And then, you know, gym itself. So I obviously mentioned Pure Gym, that there's a basket of kind of gym locations and Pure Gym locations that I follow. I'm actually a member of both.
You're doing a lot of due diligence there. You're sort of like testing the services out.
It's helpful because you see, you know, you see how often Pure Gym puts up the membership costs, and you can see that gym actually lag that. So it was quite a nice discount between those two. Again, another thing that we think can close over time, and obviously be number two. You know, there's a much longer pathway there for gym to expand. And then finally, just in the unit economics, you know, you're talking about kind of 30% on invested capital for a mature gym, and it takes 90 days to mature. So, you know, all of those things are positive for us. You know, the market setup is positive. You're adding more gyms. You know, they think they can add 75 gyms over the next few years. That's 30% more than today. You can charge more, as I said, you know, discount versus Pure. The costs are managed better than they have been in the past. So, you know, the stock used to be much higher, and then they had you know, some kind of cost inflation, but we think that's much better managed now. And then, you know, as I said, mature unit economics, 30% plus, that is all good. So, you know, the question is, you know, does the company make money? And, you know, it's on a 40 times PE, and you would say, well, cash flow coming out of the business is basically nil each year, but you know, that is because they're investing in new sites. You know, in my view, the way you have to look at it is, you know, let's take this on an owner earnings basis. Let's say, you know, we stop expanding completely today and we just manage the estate that we've got today for maintenance, and that's it. Well, I think if you do that, it's on a, you know, it's on a 10 times cash flow yield, which, you know, is, well, equivalent of 10 times, not 40 times. And, you know, if you can continue, you know, I think, you know, obviously within that, expansion is now fully self-funded. So, you know, we don't have an issue with that, you know, investing to be bigger. You know, yes, if you're going to take on more equity to do it, that's dilutive. So we're not, you know, we're kind of less keen on that. But if you can do it all self-funding and the economics, unit economics continue to stack up, then, you know, that for us is a nice place to be. And look, if you take that management plan at face value, add 75 gyms, let's say that takes them to kind of 2030 to do that, that maybe a couple of years slower than they expect. And then you say, there's nothing else for us to do here. We're just going to manage these gyms as they are, maintenance capex only. You're talking, I think, you know, my numbers, you're saying this company will earn 50% of its market cap in excess cash per year. So, you know, that is, you know, a big, to us, a big cash machine. And ultimately, those companies get acquired.
Is that 10% cash flow yield after all the lease costs, the rental?
Yes, after lease costs, yeah.
And the interest fees and stuff like that as well?
Yes.
Wow, God, I didn't realise. I was like, okay, I'll have a look at that myself. Good idea. Because, I mean, the pricing, you're right. If it's like less than 30 quid, I mean, I get down the local council pool and stuff. And that's 40 quid.
Well, that's it.
I mean,
exactly.
And David Lloyd, as you know, is, I mean, you know, 120, 150 a month. So
exactly, yeah. Exactly. Look, you know, David Lloyd's actually looking to IPO, I think, you know, might not happen, but potentially this year. Mm. And, you know, the more expensive gyms, the unit economics are better. But again, you know, for us, we just quite like this space. You know, it's, you know, in my view, quite an easy hold, and the valuation, if you can look at it on a cash earnings basis as opposed to P&L, you know, so take out the P&L, you know, it's obviously quite punitive on IFRS 16 for early companies that are expanding quickly. Then, you know, you get something that makes a lot more sense.
Good. Okay. Well, let's move on to another area. Let's go to industrials. We've got one of your really good winners, Avingtrans, which is basically a specialist engineer niche, sort of like parts and services for the nuclear industry, defense. They also do for transport, like HS2 safety doors. But they did a big placing for 21 million quid at £6.30 about a month ago to seriously expand their capacity out in Michigan into the nuclear area, where they think there's going to be lots of potential opportunity. Anyway, the shares just keep going up. I mean, it must be tempting to take profits, but I mean, this is like a rocket ship. What's your view anyway?
It is. I think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, to see a UK company at, you know, this point in with this market position in this US nuclear sector, the US nuclear supply chain, which in my view over the next 5 years to a decade is going to be absolutely huge. It's fantastic. But, you know, again, it's something that we saw a long time ago. You know, it's why we liked the business to begin with. You know, they always had these market positions in nuclear, be it kind of legacy or new build, which is coming in, or even decommissioning that we had in Sellafield. That's actually why we invested in the business, you know, 7-8 years ago. Now, obviously, Sellafield's been slower and other things have come in. But, you know, it's the nice part of having that portfolio. And, you know, obviously alongside that, they've got, you know, data center cooling, and you've got, you know, magnets and quantum computing. So it's, you know, it's kind of a who's who of what's going to be a, you know, secular winner over the next decade. So we like that business. But on the nuclear side, you know, as you said, Michigan site, £20 million placing, you know, huge amount of demand for that. As well, off the institutions, as you understand it. The US want to be, it's fairly obvious, they want to be number one in AI, and the biggest bottleneck to AI compute is energy. And nuclear gives them, you know, an easy kind of way, or easier way to scale up to meet those energy demands. So that's effectively what we're leaning into. And, you know, the kind of main numbers behind that, the US signed a partnership with Westinghouse. You know, there's $80 billion of funding there, plus another $17.5 billion for a long lead supply item. So the funding is there, and you know, the kind of government momentum is there, and the demand is there as well. So, you know, again, you know, a nice setup to have. But it's been, you know, I think US nuclear has been kind of bubbling away for a couple of years now. You know, we've seen quite a few of these SMR plays, de-SPACing at kind of $2 to $4 billion valuations with no turnover. So, you know, there's obviously quite a lot of demand there. People seeing the opportunity. There's a lot of consolidation in that supply chain. You've got kind of nuclear adjacent companies IPOing, even kind of the established legacy nuclear players in the US are IPOing, people like Holtec, Westinghouse itself, I actually saw looking to IPO as well. And, you know, some of the more established players on kind of mid-30s EBITDA multiples in the US. Yeah. So, you know,
30s, it's, you know,
exactly. So, you know, we're talking 20 times PE here to own, you know, a company which kind of has a bona fide legacy position in the US nuclear market and has, you know, that moat, the end stamp moat, which is obviously, you know, exceptionally difficult to achieve, all in the face of a fairly kind of hollowed out US nuclear market. I think if you go back a couple of decades, there was kind of fivefold number of suppliers in that US nuclear space. Obviously, it all become, you know, they turned off the funding, and, you know, the cost to maintain these end stamps and certifications are kind of $2 to $4 million a year. So if you've not got the demand, then you're not going to pay the bills to maintain it. And so all that supply chain fell away. And, you know, here we are suddenly with Hayward Tyler, with the end stamps, with the kind of market position in the US, and loads of kind of legacy business with Westinghouse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's fantastic, and it's super exciting. And, you know, that £20 million pound placing supports, you know, on the management numbers, supports 9 to 17 million pounds worth of additional EBITDA. And that's on a business that makes, you know, 20 million of EBITDA today. So, you know, you're kind of talking about 50% uplift, you know, maybe it's a double on top. And, you know, do you get a better multiple than 20 times PE along that journey? Yeah, I'd expect that you would. Yeah. And, you know, actually, you know, if they can scale that business, I don't see why you couldn't, you know, I think we actually talked about this on the call last year. You know, what do we think will be the next exit for AVG? And Hayward Tyler was always kind of positioned as that. They've obviously kind of doubled down. They said, you know, we're not going to divest it now. We're going to invest. But, I mean, you take this business, divest it in 5 years' time, and you've added 9 to 17 million of EBITDA on top of what we've got today. You know, that's going to be a valuable
120 million at least.
Well, there you go,
50% of the market cap.
Yeah,
just on the other areas, because I mean, they've got some pretty good crown jewels in the other areas that I've been talking about. Yeah. I mean, Booth Industries, for instance, which is basically the blast proof doors which go into HS2 tunnels, but also into nuclear facilities and submarines and stuff like that. They've talked about that sort of potentially being disposed of, or it's thought of that it's been disposed of. What's your view on it? And also the eventual spin out of its really sort of like quite exciting, you know, Medica and Magnetica and
Adaptix. Yeah, I think, yeah, Booths, again, you know, when they came to us last, they said, you know, potentially, again, we could dispose of this, but we think we can double the earnings in this business. You know, there's a good enough pipeline of visible demand there that we can lean into that. And, you know, of course, our view is we'll do that. You know, don't dispose of it now. You know, on the medical side, that's obviously loss making just now, and they are investing, and evidently it is taking them longer to commercialize and get the FDA sign off, especially in Magnetica. So, you know, that's kind of less obvious. But again, I think, you know, it's not a management team that I doubt. You know, I'm sure that they will make a success of that. You know, it might take a little bit longer. Fine. You know, we can kind of live with that if Hayward Tyler is going to do 20% a year for the next 5 years. And kind of fund the losses within medical. I guess, you know, the only kind of downside I might say is, well, if we weren't funding the losses in medical, then we most likely wouldn't have had to do a £20 million placing, which was obviously, you know, 10% dilutive. So as an existing holder, you know, that would be the only kind of pushback. But obviously, you know, when they made that decision to invest in the medical businesses, we didn't know so much about the US nuclear market and how big of an opportunity that was going to be. So, so I guess you kind of take it at face value. But look, I think that's, you know, 20 million placing to add 50% minimum to the earnings of that business at 10% dilution. It's not, you know, it's not a particularly bad outcome.
Yeah, and I think with that Medicare or the medical division, I think ultimately medical imaging, basically, I think ultimately it will be spun out because they've recruited Stuart Gall from Intelligence Ultrasound a couple of years ago, and I'm sure his ticket is basically to get it commercially singing, and then they'll spin it out or sell it or something like that. Okay, great. That's a fabulous stock to continue. Yep. Let's go to another one, industrial. Let's go to Volex, another one which has done really well. It does sort of like high performance optical and power cables for all kinds of applications like EVs, industrials, and MRR machines and medical. But the area that is absolutely going ballistic, not surprisingly, is advanced optical and power cables for data centers. Take us through this one, because I think the CEO or the exec chairman, Nat Rothschild, they haven't placed a foot wrong on this one.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's been fantastic. Obviously, we held it in the IHT funds. We had to sell out of it because they moved to the main list, but we still own it for, we've got a few mandates that we can manage, AMAN main list. So, it's in there. It's still a high conviction position. We buy more of it when the shares get to, £5, which they have done. Thankfully, they came back after hitting seven. So we managed to own some more. As you said, there's five divisions, CIT, which includes that data centers business, the high speed business, off highway, EVs, consumer and medical. So I think if you take all those markets, bar data centers, they should all do kind of mid single digits over the kind of medium long term. Volex should, we think should do a bit better than that, because they are with the sector leaders that doing slightly better than the market, and they should be able to take more share and actually move up the complexity curve and the value curve as well. So we spent a lot of time talking about that at the Capital Markets Day. And then high speed, as you said, is certainly doing a lot better than that. They doubled that high speed business last year. And if you look at basically any other comp in the market, BizLink, TE, Amphenol, they are, those high speed businesses are more or less doubling year on year as well. So, quite a nice place to be there. I think, our perspective, Capital Markets Day was good. They set out a new target, $2 billion of earnings in 5 years at 12% margin, earning 20% in capital employed. So that's all, kind of good stuff, high level stuff. Last time they set out a 5-year plan, they hit it in 4 years. And I suspect they do that again. So you'd be talking about them kind of doubling this business again in 4 years. So again, you get to, what's that? It's better than 15% a year, at least slightly less than 20% a year. So that's, a nice place to be. And then again, high speed. So if you look at the numbers, FY26, they did 230 million of turnover in that high speed division. But I think you have to look at the halves, because half on half, they did 86 million in the first half, 150 in the second half.
Wow.
So it doubled half on half. So I think consensus, in my view, is actually quite light here. Especially if you look at the comps, again, I was looking at them last night just for this call. BizLink, one of the best comps, they were up, their high speed business up 11% month to month, actually plus 47% in July versus last year. Amphenol plus 60% in Q2, TE plus 30% in the third quarter. I think you can say that this high speed business might do another kind of 30, maybe 40% this year, quite conservatively.
Yeah.
And if you pull all that together, again, with the margin, so they said a 12% margin target in 5 years time, but actually, look at these FY26 numbers. They put aside, I think it was $8 million for some quality defects. In my view, I think they most likely overdid that eight. And so I think they kind of sandbagged the margin a bit on those numbers. So I think if you take that out, it's more like an 11% margin business. So they're kind of halfway there to the 12% margin target. Obviously, consensus is way behind that. And if you put that together with high speeds, which I think you know, I think consensus is 270 for this year. I think it's going to be, you know, easily 30 million better than that, if not 60 million better than that. And the last bit, the margin on high speed, again, I think we've got a good look at this. I think margin on high speed is 25%. So if you put all that together, I think you get back to potentially quite a good beat on this year's numbers.
With you. I mean, if you just take as a data point and you look at Micron and SK Hynix, and it's kind of, and you look at high bandwidth memory, I mean, they're just selling out and pricing's going up and up and up. And to operate those in a data center, you need high speed cables. So it's not surprisingly, Volex is doing pretty well because you can't have a high bandwidth chip without a high speed cable because it's pretty useless otherwise. So
I think, you know, all the kind of catalysts are there. They've got a buyback ongoing. Again, they've never bought back shares. So, you know, that's got to be a signal that the management think that the shares are undervalued. And I think we've got an AGM statement on the 25th of August. You know, given all the sector news, as I said, Bizlink, Amphenol, TE, there's just no way that the AGM statement's not going to be positive, in my view. So I think the setup there is good. I think we'll have some good earnings out of that business this year.
Good. Okay, let's stay in the tech sector. Let's go into software, though. We've got Drew is asking about, I think, one you own, Eagle Eye, which is basically an expert in promotional products for very large supermarkets around the world. Sells the actual applications to most of the supermarkets in the UK, increasingly gaining a footprint in the US. They lost a big customer about 18 months ago, but essentially, they've just gone from strength to strength still then. And if you strip that out, I think the last trading update, they were doing ARR growth of 20% plus. Yep. They've got the bit between the teeth, the double revenue in the next 5 years. Anyway, what's your take? The shares have responded pretty well over the last, well, since that, the contract loss 18 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's just about when I was on last time. Obviously the shares have come back well, you know, that loss was obviously, you know, quite significant in the context of how we understood this business, which was to have, you know, sticky customers. But, you know, they've obviously significantly beaten the expectations that we had and that the market had after that Neptune loss. In my view, I think, you know, the main kind of catalyst here is actually what happens to the business. I think back, they'd signed this this global OEM deal, which we now know as SAP. You know, there's been a few other kind of helpful wins in the US, but, you know, that OEM deal, you know, effectively embeds the AIR loyalty capability into SAP, and, you know, that is something that they, you know, the way we understand it is they had attempting to build that themselves and they'd been unable to do it. Hence we have this deal, and, you know, ultimately it's difficult to see why or how, you know, they wouldn't just want to buy Eagle Eye. You know, we don't have a lot of positions where the thesis is this business will get taken out.
Yeah,
but this is kind of one of those couple. And if we look at comps, especially loyalty comps, you know, they're kind of high teens EBITDA multiples.
I know that there was another one actually. Adyen bought. I can't remember what it was called. For 12 times sales.
Yeah, I'm not going to say we're going to sell a business at 12 times sales, but, you know, I'll take a conservative kind of high teens, 20s EBITDA, but in a few years' time, once we've got the benefits out of our base and your customers, so.
Yeah, hopefully the business will carry on doing well. Okay, let's stay in the soft sector. We've got Steve. He's asking about another one you own, Traxys, which is basically a tech hardware and software expert in largely rail tech, but other sort of transport applications. It's gone through quite a lot of strategic repositioning announcements over the last month. It bought a a rail tech software company, Mistral from First Group, the transport company, in sort of like, I think it's the sort of the front office train operations with customers and stuff, for 48 million quid, which is quite a big number compared to their market cap of about 100, and then sold about 2 weeks later. It's lower margin, it's long core events business. Anyway, with all that sort of moving parts, what's your view on the actual business?
Yeah, look, the question here had always been, well, you know, what is going to happen with the cash? Because actually, you know, earnings had kind of stagnated for, you know, at least a few years. The multiple had come back. You know, they'd had this CP7 headwind in the UK. So, you know, the spend out the talks just hadn't come as expected. Now, as you said, what they've done is helpful, because you always had this kind of high margins software business. Yes, it slowed down a bit, but, you know, good sticky essential software in that UK space alongside the events business. And it was never actually that obvious how they fit together, and I think actually they also didn't fit together particularly well at all. So you know, I think to lose events for, you know, it was a low single digit multiple, so, you know, you could argue that actually they maybe should have held on to that for a slightly better valuation. But it does clean up the business, and, you know, lets you kind of focus on the kind of scalable software and the multiple that you attach to that. You know, the business they bought, 30% EBITDA business, as you said, you know, it's data solutions into the talk. So it's, you know, it lets you communicate with passengers, manage demand, manage the assets. So, you know, again, quite a nice business. They paid quite a lot to own it. You know, almost 4x sales, I think 12x EBITDA.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we have to wait and see. You know, I don't know quite as well as Judith.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, look, I think if you can, as I said, you know, you lose part of the business that the market doesn't give you any value for, i.e. events, and you buy a business which the market wants to value on, which is sticky high margin software, then, you know, that's fairly obvious.
Key investment thesis comes down to when Great British Railway is all set up and all operational by October 2027, if that actually does happen. But it looks as though with all the TOCs, the train operating companies, are rolling into that. But let's assume that timetable does happen. Then the investment thesis must be, we've had 3 years of barren sort of capex and software and investment spending all the train operating companies. It's got to have a catch up. I mean, just look at what happened the last week when you had two train accidents, you know.
And one a month ago as well, you know,
So you've got this huge, and they should be, in theory, I think the investment thesis, they're going to be in the A-ball position come next year to pick up an acceleration, a catch-up capex of 3 years. They haven't been doing, they've just been doing maintenance, basically, expend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's it. But, you know, the thesis has been, you know, there's been underinvestment, obviously, as you said, for quite a few years, and we've always been expecting that catch-up, and we've never quite got it. And at the same time, the government is, you know, is quite happy to spend money on lots of other things as well. So, you know, you know, we will see, and there's obviously other kind of budget demands on GBR, or there will be. So, yes, look, I mean, we like it as a kind of software play, sticky, high margin. Yeah, okay. So,
okay, good. Let's stay in the software sector. We've got Emma, she's asking about when you own Phonix, which is a sort of a messaging software business that helps television and radio stations run competitions. So, for instance, Sky or BB, oh yeah, probably the Sky or ATV at the World Cup will do. Win tickets to go to the World Cup final out in New York, and everybody has to vote and pays £1. Anyway, they'll be doing all the technical software behind that. Business keeps going from strength to strength. I think it's got a sort of 80-90% market share in the UK. So it's had to expand overseas. Went to Ireland, France, now Portugal, and I think Switzerland's another one. How do you see this one? The shares have reacted poorly to quite a good organic growth strategy.
Yeah, so again, as you said, a huge dominant share in the UK, and that was, you know, an absolute cash cow. Still is, you know, it's a cash cow business. You know, fantastic market for them. You know, they have all the UK kind of media companies, most of the UK media companies on board. The issue for them has been, well, you know, you got to 90% share, then what? You know, you obviously have to go and invest in new markets. And what they did, you know, instead of doing one market at a time, they invested in a few, you know, you called them all out there. And what we kind of had was just a kind of stagnation of earnings. You know, they had always kind of done double digits a year. That fell back. And actually, you know, the last update was the first kind of pickup I think we saw. You know, net sales up 13%, 21 million. EBITDA was plus 11%. So, you know, that has actually got people looking at the stock again. Actually, you know, we are now hopefully beginning to see momentum in those new markets. And actually, you know, we caught up with management. There's a few kind of other opportunities emerging out of the UK as well. You know, we all know Omaze do the house giveaways, you know, enter the online competition and you win a £4 million house, but they're not actually in, they don't do DCB to enter. You can only enter online. So, you know, we think Phonics are speaking to them about using mobile to enter those competitions as well. So, you know, there's still a bit to go for in UK. But the way, you know, we would see it is, you know, super high quality business, exceptionally low capital needs. So all that cash basically is excess cash, and any kind of additional EBITDA most more or less falls to the bottom line. You know, even if sales are quite slow, or you know, investment has absorbed a bit more of earnings, you know, we're all still getting a 6% yield out of this. And you know, in the context of us aiming to do 10% TSR a year, you know, we don't actually need much more out of this business to hit that target. You know, 6% plus a bit, you know, multiple expansion or earnings expansion, you know, that gets us there. And then, you know, the upside is what happens now. And you know, we think on a fairly kind of conservative case, you can say, well, GP margin can double, can go up 50%. You know, it might double in a slightly longer time with a few more locations. But out of the places that they've called out, or that you called out, we think you can add 50% to GP margin. And again, you know, more, you know, that's almost all going to fall to the bottom line. And that will be the major earnings catalyst. And you will get, you know, a decent, healthy multiple expansion in the back of that.
Yeah. Do you think long term their take rate is going to stay the same? Because it's about 3-5%. I know they've got, this is critical, mission critical type of software. And yeah, therefore it has good pricing power. But in payments, the take rate sort of like
is much, you know, lower, sort of, yeah.
Basically it's going to zero.
Yeah.
if you listen to MasterCard and these people with using stablecoin and all that kind of, you know, basically blockchain and all that rubbish, then it's certainly going down. So what's your view on the longevity of that sort of take rate at 3-5%?
Yeah, we're comfortable there. I mean, there's a lot less competition. And, you know, yes, if you're in the big kind of global payment space, then, you know, that is going to get competed away. Here, it's a lot more difficult. And it is so margin, you know, even at that percentage, it is so margin enhancing for the media companies. And, you know, we kind of had this anecdote. I won't tell you the name, but the, you know, big UK media company, a customer of Phonics, you know, they are one of the major players in UK competitions, and they make 40 million a year bottom line out of these competitions. You know, it's such a marginal high earner for them that, you know, we're fairly comfortable on the economics to Phonics. You know, we don't see that getting squeezed.
Yeah, no, it's crucial, isn't it, to the television stations and the radios, because, I mean, their advertising revenues are going down, so they need more and more competitions to be successful. So you're probably right, actually. They'll be forced to run even more, you know.
Well, I think that's it.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, that is exactly what's happening, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, ITV or STV just launched some new audio stations in Scotland, and they are now bolting on competitions to that. So I think, you know, that competition space does continue to get larger.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's move to the auto sector. We've got one which has been a previous darling, AB Dynamics. These guys do the testing of all things safety in cars around the world. They've had a really sort of like a, up to this point, an almost like uncheckered past. But the auto sector has gone through trials and tribulations over the last 12 months. We've obviously had the influx of EVs into Europe, which has hit the likes of the big German auto manufacturers. Plus, they've had the tariffs out in the US. And what that's meant, unfortunately, is that a lot of the auto manufacturers have slowed down their development of new cars. Anyway, they came out with a pretty sort of like shock profit warning about a month ago. What's your latest view on AB Dynamics? Always been thought of as a high quality company.
Yeah, it has. And putting the earnings miss, that expectations miss to one side, I still think it is a high quality company. You know, it is a leader in that testing equipment market, and it is actually quite a nice, you know, well, we think quite a nice niche to be in. I still think that the kind of long-term dynamics are still there. You know, testing standards and safety standards continue to get tighter and tighter. You know, you will have, you know, we do have more automotive models and platforms coming to the market. You know, where we had, you know, 2 decades ago, we just had internal combustion. Now we've got internal combustion plus plug-in PHEVs, and then we've got pure EVs on top. So, you know, within the OEMs, there's more platforms within that, which, you know, is a good kind of long-term dynamic to have. And then obviously the testing standards themselves become more challenging. And, you know, NCAP, for example, you know, will, you know, double the number of tests, you know, over the next 5 years. So, you know, if you're at least at a market level, if you're there, then, you know, we think that's a good place to be. Now, where we got caught out, so we bought this business after the first half. So, you know, the shares were, I think we paid £9.20, £9.30 for most of our block of shares. So, yeah, that was obviously after the multiple had come all the way back. Now, what did we know at that time? So we knew that there was a significant gap to H2. So that was what effectively we were counting on, that, you know, the demand on the core testing side would hold up. We knew that there were issues in Vadotech, which was the Chinese testing business that they bought. They took an impairment in H1, so we knew about that. We took a view that actually most likely that might just have to go to nothing anyway. So we were kind of comfortable there. We knew that the simulation business, so this is kind of big simulators into, you know, F1 and OEMs. So those are kind of big high ticket bits of work. You know, you ship 2 simulators in half a year, that's worth kind of 10 or 15 million worth of turnover. So, you know, you kind of hit or miss your numbers just on that. But we took a view, you know, they said we need 2 of these in the second half to hit the numbers. And, you know, we kind of thought, well, if they get one and one falls into the first half next year, then we can get comfortable with that. As you called out, you know, the huge weakness here that we kind of completely didn't see coming was in the core testing business. And that, you know, they pulled back consensus there by, I think, £15-17 million, which is, it's almost an entire quarter's worth of earnings in a normal year. Now, you know, as you said, that was, you know, we caught up with management, that was basically all German OEMs. You know, they are cutting jobs and they're cutting costs, and it's all about cash management. Now, I guess the question now becomes, do these platforms and the development that would be exposed to ABDP, does that fall away completely, or is it just delayed and they're squeezing, they're managing the cash as tightly as they can? So instead of placing the orders 12 months in advance of them knowing that they have to spend on these testing, on the testing equipment for the next platform, do they, do, you know, does that order come 6 months in advance or a quarter in advance? And that's the one that's difficult to know. So we're still kind of TBC here.
How much of their business is from the Chinese auto? Because they, if you look at their actual the numbers, I mean, I did over the weekend or a couple of weeks ago, and back in 2019, so we're talking of 6-7 years before the pandemic, they were doing 1 million vehicles exported from China a year. Okay, 1 million, right? They're now doing 10 million a year, in 10 times, and so obviously, you know, if AB Dynamics need to have exposure to the Chinese, the BYDs, to do the testing, to, you know, take up the slack. That's, I mean, that 10 million is an enormous volume, you know. So if they've got strength in all the Western OEMs, have they got equal strength in the Chinese?
So not equal, but they do have quite, you know, the Asian business is big. I forget the exact splits, but it's obviously it's in the accounts. But I think, I don't have my paper open, but I think it was kind of 30% Asia.
Right, okay, fine.
And that is off an exceptionally low base. So, you know, it's not like they haven't won or they haven't taken share as that Asian OEM market has boomed. You know, they're taking, you know, they have one business there. I think, you know, the issue is that I think the German OEMs for them are just significantly larger.
Yeah,
okay. Certainly. Well, you know, they don't tell you who the big customers are explicitly. But obviously I would expect that VW and VW, you know, the sub sub labels are significant for AB Dynamics. Yeah. And that's the headwind. So look, I mean, again, margin's still 20%. They've got tons of cash in the balance sheet. I think they've got 40 million of net cash. And you know, it has been a fantastically successful compounder up until you know, we bought it.
Do you think it'll be taken over? Because there's actually quite a big trade buyer in Austria who is private. It's got about 2 or 3 times bigger. There must be synergies of taking somebody, one of your competitors, out of the market.
Potentially. I mean, again, you know, if you look at what the buyers like, they like cash flow, and you know, they like good market positions in these kind of niche markets, and you know, that would certainly consolidate. I think I saw you comment on this before. Was it EVL?
Yeah, that's it.
There's other businesses in that kind of core testing segment that I might have thought of first, but it's definitely not.
Okay. You
know, I wouldn't say never. But again, yeah, those two companies will have exposures to this, I imagine, to the same companies, to the same OEMs. So you know, you'd be doubling down on that. But look, I think, you know, where it is, it's obviously bounced off the lows, which is helpful. And you know, we can continue to kind of discuss with management and attempt to form a view on FY27. But again, you know, even they sound quite cautious on what that's going to look like.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to another big development over the past year. We've had the SaaS apocalypse, as everybody knows, and let's go to we've got Tim. He's asking about YouGov, that basically is really an expert in all things consumer panel stroke sort of research. It's obviously been hit by the advent or the thought of the sentiment in terms of agentic AI and information services being disintermediating some of their information services and their consumer panel research that they do. The shares have actually started to edge back up after the worst of the SaaS apocalypse in April. What's your latest view? Shares historically, this is very, very cheap trade at less than 10 times PE.
Yeah. 8 times, I think, for this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, so look, we, you know, YouGov has been a name darling for, had up until I think 21, 22 had been a name darling. You know, I think it was 14, 15 quid a share on 50 times earnings, or, you know, more than 50 times earnings actually. And, you know, they kind of had this cascade of bad news since then, you know, a bit more competition out of kind of well-funded startups, you know, data quality issues, margin headwinds, kind of customer issues, slowing top line. Then they made this big acquisition of a consumer panel business called Shopper in Germany, which I think, you know, the market didn't seem to particularly understand. And alongside that, they took on a lot of debt. And then, you know, the next thing, we had SaaSpocalypse and these kind of fears, as you said, on synthetic data. So, you know, I'll come back to the synthetic data point. You know, what did we actually like? I mean, the main thing for us with YouGov is the quality of the data and this kind of longitudinal panel that they have maintained for, you know, for over 20 years. So, you know, clients use it for awareness and perception, you know, lets them know what's going on in their markets. And, you know, I heard this good anecdote the other day that in Dieselgate, VW went to YouGov on the day that kind of exploded. And, you know, they asked YouGov if they could buy into their survey data. Now, you know, YouGov, you know, if you go to another survey panel company, they would have to build the survey and they would then have to go out and start surveying to give you a view on what the perception is. You know, YouGov's data is just continuous and they had 20 years worth of data on VW anyway. So at the point of time that scandal, you know, hit the headlines, you know, VW can immediately see what is the effect on their perception. So, you know, we think there's a huge amount of value in that. And at, you know, we bought this, I think we bought the first block at about £2 and then we bought it down to £1.50. We thought that the value in that data was completely overlooked just on that. And then the synthetic piece, which is where, you know, people have become, you know, quite concerned. So the idea is that, you know, you can ask a language model to form an opinion on a population, and, you know, it can do that, but it will be, you know, it's completely synthetic data that it will use. And you know, we think at some point people will, you know, and people are saying, well, you know, how can we make decisions based on this if it's not based on any kind of quantifiable human perception today? And actually that's where YouGov comes in. You know, they can, because they have this continuous panel, they can test it daily, they can ask surveys into the panel daily, they know who the survey takers are, and they can ask the same people questions over time. You know, you can form synthetic views on that data. And then you can form synthetic, effectively you can form synthetic panels on the back of that. But, you know, YouGov's one of the only ones, in our view, actually the only one that can do that. Mm. So you know, we think they're in quite a good position there if the view is that synthetic is the way forward. You know, again, synthetic, fine, but it has to be based on humans, not just a language model. You know, we've heard all the news about LLM hallucinations. You know, LLMs have their own biases. So, you know, the only way to ensure that you're using good quality synthetic data is to make sure that it's backed up by human beings. And that's what YouGov is able to do.
Hmm. Yeah, it's quite interesting because, you know, YouGov hasn't been exactly correct like many other pollsters when it comes to elections. They've gone to their panel and the actual results they've slipped up because people don't actually vote the way they say they're going to vote.
Yeah,
for numerous different reasons. So if you had somebody like, I don't know, Google or Meta or TikTok even, And they've got really sort of like, you know, tightly defined segmentation of consumers. They've probably got a better idea of getting, you know, views about how people will choose and react and behave in certain circumstances, given their historical data, and actually, you know, guess rather than actually getting somebody to say what they're going to do. Because it isn't, when somebody says what they're, it doesn't mean it's right, which is quite interesting in terms of, you know, getting it the correct, the more accurate. You'd have to back test it or do somehow to try and, what in certain circumstances, what is more accurate? Is it basically some, you know, certain situations synthetic, or is it actually actual? And actual has a lot of problems because, as I say, people don't buy or vote or choose things the way they say they're going to do it.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's obviously a concern, but, you know, again, we think that that YouGov panel is much higher quality. And actually what they've added, you know, in the back end, they've added things like voices where, you know, you complete a survey and then they can ask you via AI actually, but they can ask you a bunch of questions based on that. So it's, you know, why did you vote this way? You know, what makes you think this? And if your view on something has changed, they can dig into that and ask you why that has changed. And that's something that, you know, yes, Google might have data, but they can't go back to the data. They can't go back to that person where they got the data point and say, why did you do this? Why did you change your view? This is how you thought about it, you know, 6 months ago. So what's changed in the 6 months? So, you know, again, if we think that data, and, you know, data is becoming more valuable, you know, all LLMs are feeding off the same data on the internet. If you have a data set which they don't have access to, and you can continuously go back to the human beings that underpin it, and you can ask them more qualitative questions on views that they have given you, then that is exceptionally valuable. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, the Metas and the Googles explicitly can do that. You know, look, yeah, the large language models actually use YouGov for their surveys, for their perception data. So, you know, I think it's quite a fascinating place to be. Obviously, it's one of those ones you can take a view either side. But yeah. I think, you know, again, as I said, we like the data set. We like the moat that they have there. We think there will always be demand for high quality data backed in genuine human opinion. And if you can continue to add qualitative aspects to that, to give your customers more value, and you can identify why and when people are kind of changing their view on certain subjects or certain topics, and that's exceptionally valuable. And it's not something that just analyzing past data can show you. And look, as you said, it's, you know, it's cheap. It's 8x earnings next year. there's a load of self-help margin to come in. You know, actually AI, we think, can be a massive margin tailwind. So, you know, when they're doing bespoke surveys, that takes a lot of human effort to build those surveys for the customers. We think a lot of that can be automated, and a lot of headcount can be taken out of the business. So, you know, positive here. I think, you know, EPS CAGR for the next couple of years is about 20%. So, again, if we can capture some of that and a bit of multiple expansion as the market sits up and says, you know, this business is a lot higher quality than what we thought it was, then, you know, I think we do quite well.
Brilliant. Okay, good. Let's move on. We've nearly been going in an hour. So, is your timing okay, Nick?
Timing's
okay.
Good.
Okay, good. Right, we'll whiz through a few others. Then we've got Simon. He's asking about Restore, which is basically a document storage archiving business. It also does shredding of documents, and also it does electronic communications communications for the NHS. Business has done very well. What's your latest on this one?
Yeah, it's done, you know, again, done fantastically well. I think, you know, many people would say it's just been a bit dull. But, you know, again, for us, you know, we quite like those businesses. You know, you can buy something that's doing, you know, double digits EPS compounding for 10 times earnings. You know, you're always going to do well if you own that. Yeah, I think I guess the way, I think there was maybe some concern in the past that that, you know, the core of that business, which is the physical kind of document store, would go digital. And, you know, obviously in some kind of cases that will happen. But, you know, there's a nice moat there. You know, they have, I think they've got 20 million boxes. You know, companies, governments are mandated to hold those documents. You've got embedded customers there. You've got high switching costs. So nice, again, kind of nice place to be. I think if you do the maths on that, it works out about £20 a box on the 20 million boxes. If they digitize those boxes, you know, obviously that's a one-off income, but I think they, you know, the kind of numbers they give us, you'd be looking at like 20 times that £6 to digitize a box. So, you know, it might be one-off income, but at 20 times, you know, what you'd be paying to store the box, it's not exactly bad income. And, you know, if it happens, then, you know, we're going to do phenomenally well out of this one. And again, you know, looking at that core business on a kind of some of the parts business, some of the parts basis, we always used to say that you get that core documents business at a discount to the market cap, and you get all the other bits on top for nothing. You know, that discount has kind of closed slightly, but we still think that's a kind of, you know, ex leases, that's maybe a 50, 55 million EBITDA business. That's maybe kind of 40 million bottom line after tax cash flow with inflation linkage. You know, that is most likely still worth, you know, to a good buyer, that's maybe worth more than the market cap. Yeah. It should be worth more than the market cap today. Mm-hmm. And then you've got other parts of the business which are doing, you know, 20, 25 million before overheads, you know, call it 15, 18 million after overheads. So, you know, you're still getting that. You know, obviously there's a chunk of debt in there as well, but you're still getting that for a decent discount. So, you know, we like it.
Yeah, no, as you say, it's a good recurring revenue business that's going cheap and well run. So it's got a lot going for it. Okay, good. We've got Jane asking about another one, which has been very good for you long term, Cohort in the defence services sector. It had a really lovely contract that it won the back end of last week in sonar for Polish submarines through, I think, its partner Saab. Adding to a contract I think it already had, which was in sonar for submarines out in Italy. Anyway, the shares have gone from strength to strength. It hit about £9 when people were worried about the UK defence sort of like strategic review in December, and now it's 14. What's your latest on it?
Yeah, I mean, again, fantastic to see that. You know, that so if you think about the business, actually, you think it hit £9 because they came out, excuse me, with a kind of bigger H2 weighting, which the market thought was a bit unexpected. No, the kind of the foundations of that are, you've got this comms and intelligence business, which is you know, good 20% margin business, has been for quite a while, is, you know, potentially is actually over earning. And then you've got sensors and effectors, which includes ELAC, the sonar business. There's also Chess Dynamics, and you've got C Naval Systems in there as well. Now, the whole kind of thesis is comms and intel, nice steady earner, sensors and effectors should be a mid-teens margin, maybe actually better than a mid-teens margin business. And, you know, we kind of thought we were on that journey to that happening. Now, actually, what we got was a bit of a delay in those earnings, mainly because Chess is quite inefficient, and ELAC sonar, as you said, as you called out, they have this Italian sonar business, but they're building the first boat set just now, or they're finishing the first boat set just now, and until the customer accepts that, they book it at quite a low margin. So a lot of the, you know, we think a lot of that, the margin upside is kind of baked in, but you're still kind of having to wait to see that. Now, the announcement we got last week is obviously fantastic because it underpins the fact that they invested, I think they invested £20 million in that German Kiel sonar site. And you know, we did a capital markets day there. It was fairly obvious that that is an excellent business in a fantastic location, actually, as well, near to customers. And it has some good IP, and this obviously underpins that, and it underpins, you know, a good amount of demand for that site that they've just invested in as well. So, you know, we think that's positive. Again, you know, the upside there is obviously all about the margin in sensors and effectors and how quickly they can unlock that. They're investing in the Chess site, which, you know, I've not not been to for a while, but it's on one big estate, and there's lots of kind of sheds and workshops, none of which are kind of connected together. So it makes kind of volume out of Chess quite difficult to achieve at high margin. And that's been the issue. So they're investing in that site, they'll consolidate it. They've invested in the personnel as well. So, you know, we think that hopefully those margin headwinds, that the execution issues are behind us, and that business can get back to, you know, what it should be doing, mid-teens margins. Actually, I think that they can do a lot better than that. You know, if they when they get into kind of volume sonar with the Orca subs, the Polish Orca subs, and Italy, I actually think that division, you know, could be closer to 20%.
Yeah, and their order book is massive, isn't it?
And the order book's huge. Yeah, but you just—I mean, it's again, you have to execute well as well. So, you know, you build the order book, but you have to deliver the orders, and you've got to deliver them at a good margin.
You're a tough man to please, you aren't you? Okay, well, let's go to another one with a huge amount of order book. We've got Martin asking about Coastal and Maritime Protection Services business, SRT Marine. Again, sort of like being quite black and white sort of like stock between sort of investors, Marmite stock, should we say. Yeah. But the shares have done very well. They've won a lot of, they've got a big pipeline, won some big Asian orders to provide radar systems out and in the Middle East to protect coastal against sort of like drug smuggling, organized crime, illegal boats, and obviously the security of the borderline. So what's your latest on this one?
Yeah, so again, it's newish to us. We started buying it kind of, I guess, middle of last year, maybe about 50p, maybe paid a bit more for that over the kind of block that we've got. And then they did a placing, which we did a bit of as well, when was that? Earlier this year. So, you know, we quite like it. It's a small position, but we like the space, and we like this kind of turnkey command system, coastal MDA that they're building. And if you think about it, you know, this is a turnkey system. So you're going to Kuwait, you're building them command centers down the coastline, you're putting in the hardware, you're building the towers, you're putting sensors in the towers that look out, you know, over their domain. You're adding in, you should be adding in UAVs and USVs into that. And the main bit is you do the software that ties it all together. And actually, you know, we think, you know, obviously, you know, just now the market sees it as, you know, maybe quite a low margin, quite a potentially a difficult business. But, you know, you fast forward a bit to these more established nations. Once you've built the command center, you've put in all the hardware. This is about bolting on new modules into that software stack. And you know, we just cannot see a situation where, you know, you have the, you know, Kuwaitis, for example, who will not just want to continuously expand the system. And, you know, we have actually kind of started to see that. This, you know, again, with Kuwait, we started as an offshore system only. They've now said that they want to add in land border surveillance as well, which, you know, is kind of multiples of the size of the coastal, the offshore piece. And then, you start adding in USVs, you start adding in UAVs, you know, you're adding in more sensors, more data into this software platform. And, you know, we think, you know, in a few years' time, that's what people will come to view it as. You know, more kind of quasi defense AI software stock.
How can a 200 or 220 million market win these kind of deals? I mean, you'd have thought it'd be a big sort of like NATO prime or something like that. It just seems amazing that these guys have got the technology and the capability to do such huge potential rollout contracts.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that there's a concern there that, you know, it's a smaller business. Can they do it? You know, we think they are doing it. Obviously, much larger nations will build it themselves, or they will use another kind of larger defense peer to do it. But I think the main thing here is that, you know, this is kind of the sole business for SRT. You know, if you're using one of the other defense companies, they will give you a package, you know, more or less off the shelf. And, you know, if it does what you want, then fine. If it doesn't, then it's not going to work, and your ability to continue to add to it is going to be a bit more limited. You know, I think as with anything, if you pick a specialist where, you know, they live or die on doing exactly what you want and building a system that you want, then, you know, you're going to get what you want. And, you know, they have obviously been doing it for a while, and there's been a few false dawns in that journey as well. Which you know, lots of legacy shareholders will know, but you know, I think, as I said, you're seeing that inflection point now. That visible sales pipeline is now, you know, 1.8 billion. Obviously, that's not all secured, but you know, the next big catalyst for the shares will be Kenya, hopefully, when they get the financing off of UKEF, and you know, that will become a solid signed customer. And then again, as we can hopefully expand the other existing customers into land domains and things like that, adding in USVs and UAVs, more sensors, more income. I think it's, you know, I Simon Tucker, the CEO, did a call a couple of weeks ago where he said the kind of medium term 5-year ambition is half a billion of turnover at 20% margin. So, you know, if we get halfway there, we'll be in a good place.
Forecast for turnover, just in comparison, is about 120 million. So to get a 500, it's that would be a fabulous result.
Exactly.
Okay, good. Let's move sectors. Let's go to Indonesian palm oil producer. We've got John asking about Anglo Eastern Plantations. These guys, the shares have done absolutely terrifically over the last 2 years, presumably as the palm oil prices increased. It took, like all the other palm oil producers, ran about, I think it was April, May. They took a bit of a bath when the Indonesian government suddenly announced that they were going to put controls over the exporting of palm oil and palm sort of like, you know, fruit and stuff like this. How do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, so again, we bought ahead of that, and we thankfully sold a chunk before that, and then we bought it all back post that warning. Actually, the Indo government walked back on a lot of that, where that was going to be kind of government mandated by, I think it was an Indonesian wealth fund. I've forgotten what they were called. It's now, you know, it's a lot softer than that. So I guess the way we kind of thought about it was this will effectively be some kind of tax somewhere in the system. So can we just take CPO, get to X mil, and then take a little bit off, you know, another $20-$30 a ton or something to kind of attempt to build in the effect of this kind of government intervention. But obviously, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like, so it's quite difficult to do. But on the other side, which we think is even more exciting, we have, you know, the demand and the supply side we think is quite exciting. So you have Indonesia moving to this B50 biofuel mandate, which will basically consume, I think, about 10% of the palm oil output domestically. So it's a, you know, huge demand catalyst alongside this El Nino event. Again, I just saw some news this morning talking about El Nino again being, you know, the biggest one ever. That will obviously affect some of the palms, and it tightens up supply. And you can look back at these other El Nino cycles, and you can fairly kind of consistently say that, you know, that these will push an El Nino event affects the supply and will push up CPO by 10 to 20% if we get the biggest one ever, you know, hopefully it'll be 20-25%. But as I said, you've got the demand side, B50, and then supply side, El Nino. So that's super tight and will obviously be a massive positive for CPO. And we are now seeing that. So I think CPO is touching 1650. If you take off the shipping costs and the export duties and the levies, then I think you get back to about 920 a ton, which is a long way. I think it's about 10% above where we have seen the last comp. So, you know, CPU is obviously going to be good this year. That's a nice catalyst for earnings. And, you know, again, what's going to happen with the stock this year? You have this kind of CPO going up, you have dated analyst forecasts, so that, you know, in our view, they're obviously going to be earnings and continuously be earnings. You've seen it with MP Evans, who we see those numbers first. You've got a nice yield, you've got a solid balance sheet with 80 million of cash. They're doing a buyback, they've got some potential, some excess land in Malaysia, which could be worth 60 or 70 million. And we've seen that they're quite active in, you know, disposing of bits of land and buying other kind of core bits of land as well. So, you know, I think all of the kind of catalysts are there, and it's on, you know, 9x PE. I think it'll be kind of mid single digit EV to EBITDA. So, so again, all positive. And, you know, I guess the last bit, how we value it, is actually on land, which is how, you know, I guess the market will value both the UK peers and also the Indonesian listed peers. But on that basis, sits at a kind of 35% discount to MP Evans and a 30% discount to the Indonesian listed palm oil peers. And over time, you know, the kind of core to our thesis was that the yield quality of AEP should continue to get better. They've been planting, they've been investing a lot more in the palms, and you don't get that benefit for a few years. But as that inflects, as we get higher yield and better OERs out of that business, we should get higher margins, and that discount to the others should begin to close.
Yeah. It hasn't had any damage at all from the earthquake last week. And also, is there any danger that the government implements, not export controls, exchange rate currency controls?
Yeah, so that's the big unknown, is obviously what will the government do. I mean, in the past, when palm oil gets too expensive, they do something. So, you know, you always have to be kind of aware that could happen. Mm. And, you know, given the governments you're dealing with, we obviously saw it a few months ago where they made that announcement as they did. So, you know, that is, you know, you can argue, you know, that's why the shares are discounted. But equally, you know, then all the palm oil peers should be discounted, and we're buying the cheapest one with, you know, we think the best earnings momentum and the most kind of opportunity to get kind of better qualities, higher yields out of those palms going forward. So, you know, again, we quite like that as a place to be. And I've not seen anything about the earthquakes. I've not seen any kind of public announcements, actually.
But, yeah, no, there hasn't been any. I was just wondering whether there was any fit between their palm oil, you know, production facilities,
yeah,
and the roads and infrastructure with what actually happened. But you know, I think that's for investors to have a look at.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Let's get moved to, we've got National Timber Merchants in the UK. Colin's asking about James Latham, that I think had one of its biggest rivals, which went bust about 18 months ago, National Timber.
Yeah.
That's obviously, it's like been a beneficial taking a rival out, but I think they distress sold all their timber panels. But volumes have gone up at James Latham. They're also apparently investing a big chunk of CapEx into a new RDC, distribution center warehouse, out in East Anglia. Yeah, putting all that together, how do you see timber merchant James Latham going forward?
Yeah, I mean, again, our whole kind of thesis here is this is a kind of steady, family-owned, family-managed compounding business. It, you know, exceptionally conservative in terms of how it's managed and the balance sheet. You know, in any other situation, you know, it would have been two times geared or something, and you know they'd expanded a much faster. But as like National Timber, when you know when the demand falls away, you go bust, and actually that's what's happened in this kind of sector time after time. And James Latham are always there to pick up the pieces, and you know the idea here is that over time they just continue to consolidate share. They serve their customers well, and you know they always have the supply. So you know, so long as you're doing those things, and you, when the market becomes difficult, you can take a bit of share, then you compound nicely. You know, actually, I thought the last set of numbers were quite good. We saw volume tick back up again. You know, some of that was on these pack sales, which is much lower margin. But again, it's all helpful for the sites to take up capacity in the sites and help margin, which is what we did see. And then the next question is, what happens with this investment in the NDC? I think it will be a few years until we see the main benefit of that. But clearly, it allows them to internalize a lot of costs. You know, a lot of their cost was to store timber in the ports, and that was becoming more and more expensive. So, you know, as they take that back into, you know, wholly owned site, we should begin to see the margin benefit there. And again, as they can fold more and more volume into a much larger site, you know, again, should begin to see margin benefits there. And they're investing in Ireland, where, you know, they can feasibly should be able to take a lot of share in that market as well. So, you know, for us on, I think it's on 12 times, and having compounded in the past at kind of double digits, you know, we think it's a nice place to be. And we don't have a lot of exposure to this sector. Obviously it's, you know, in the house building sector as an adjacent, it's been quite tough for a while, but James Latham has massively outperformed that. And you know, we think they will continue to do that.
Good. Okay. Well, we've got the last couple of questions. We've got a house builder in Scotland. We've got Chris asking about Springfield Properties, which came out with news today that I think it sold some a package or 120 plots for about 12 million quid out in Scotland. It's now got a cash net cash balance sheet, which it's done well. Seems to have restructured. What's your latest on this one? Because again, I think the whole sector house building is a bit of a Marmite area.
Yeah, whole sector is. I think you know the main, you know, the main, I guess, point you can hang your hat on if you want to do that quickly is, I think they came out in the last update and said that the demand situation in their markets was such that they believe that they can offset all of the build cost inflation, and there's not a single other house builder that I've seen that's actually said that. So you know, for us, huge positive there. That the underlying kind of dynamics of that market are that SSEN are investing, I think, £20 billion in the north of Scotland to build out, you know, new energy power lines and things like that. And these guys have the land to build the houses for the workers, and you know, once that work stops, they'll sell those houses back into the public. So you know, we quite like that. It's like the other leg of the stool. You know, as a pure house builder, we most likely wouldn't have owned it. But with that north of Scotland catalyst, we think that is a nice place to be. And as you said, you know, they've de-geared the balance sheet, and it's on, you know, I think it's on 0.7 times book.
So, there's no local bias there, is there, Nick? Because I can sense your accent there, and obviously Judith's.
Yeah, no, there's a bit of local bias. I mean, Judith lives in Inverness, so she sees the sites almost on a daily basis. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good. Scuttlebutt sort of like research, isn't it? And you're right. I mean, it's trading on, it's 0.8 of net tangible assets. So it isn't exactly expensive either, even at these prices. Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move on. We've got Caroline. She's asking about Optima Health, which again came out with results today. It's an occupational healthcare provider for businesses in the UK. Quite actually an opportune moment about occupational health, given how many people are picking up, sort of like according to Farage, picking up benefits and getting people back to work. Did a big acquisition in the island recently, PAM Healthcare, and it raised some money on the back of it. It's got quite an aggressive growth strategy. How do you see it anyway?
Yeah. I mean, exactly that. You know, again, the kind of market fundamentals we all think are positive. You know, if you're buying Optima Health, then you're buying, the leading UK company in that space. I think they've got, they've got 15% of the total market. You know, that market should do kind of mid single digits a year. So, again, a nice place to be. Kind of continue to take a bit of share via, ongoing M&A. Potentially, there's obviously quite a lot of debt in there now post PAM, but it should begin to de-gear fairly quickly. And as you said, the medium-term targets, I think, hopefully fairly well underpinned. I think the management guidance gets you back to about 40 million of adjusted EBITDA. There's kind of good underpin there. Obviously, there's the PAM deal itself, which is folded into that. There's the synergies that should come out of that. And actually, the update today was quite helpful to give us a bit more understanding on those. They've talked a bit about AI's potential to help their clinicians be a lot more efficient. So I think about half, you look at the headcount, about half of the headcount is clinicians. Those are effectively the fee earners. And they're talking about some AI tools which will effectively let them, instead of spending, if you've got 30-minute appointments, instead of spending 15 minutes typing up your notes afterwards, you can, you do it verbally. It's basically done on the fly. And, effectively, you can add, another appointment per day. It's an additional kind of 12% of capacity or something like that. So instead of employing new clinicians to fill that capacity, the existing ones can do it. So it's a nice kind of headcount cost saving there. There's loads going on, and then you have the armed forces business that should begin to build in just at the end of FY 27, and then annualizes at kind of 20 plus million a year. We should get some decent margin benefits out of that. So, I think again the setup is positive there, and they do, as you said, they're quite well incentivized to hit these earnings targets and to you've got to wonder what happens to this business. There's one big shareholder on there who has been fairly active in disposing of businesses.
Lord Ashcroft, is it?
Yes, exactly. So, we owned Marlowe, so we obviously Marlowe was split up, GRC was sold, Optima was delisted or demerged, and we ended up owning Optima via that demerger. We bought a lot more equity when it fell all the way back to, I forgot where it was, £1.50. But the other part of the Marlowe business went to Mitie. Mitie has now been sold. So, there's a lot of kind of tidying up potentially of his portfolio. Optima will be a large part of that portfolio and potentially gets tidied up as well. And if you look at some of the comps in the kind of unlisted space, there was quite a large acquisition done, I think it was earlier this year, on kind of mid-teen EBITDA multiple. I've forgotten what it was called. I don't have my notes, but if you take that, then there's potentially a huge amount of upside here.
And it's I think they're looking for what, 40 million ultimately of EBITDA. So
yeah,
basically 14 times 14. You basically, what's that? That's 640 million market cap. Is that right? Yeah, 640 million market cap. So compared to 260 at the moment. So you're right.
Yeah,
there's plenty of potential.
Minus a bit of debt, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and also, I think if you know, if Robert Jenrick, I think over the weekend of Reform UK, was talking about putting the responsibility for sickness pay and ensuring people's sort of like, you know, taking off the government and putting it into businesses. And if that's the case, then they'll probably get their people like Optimal Health, their health occupation, to do the assessment about whether people can come back to work. Yep. So if any type of that form of the Dutch model does get implemented over the next few years, they'll be in the right place at the right time.
Exactly.
So that's fantastic.
I'm just looking at my notes. So Warburg Pincus took a stake in Health Partners. So that's the other big UK one. And I think that implied multiple was 15 and a half times. So, I think there's, you know, you can kind of do the sum on that.
Nice. Yeah, good. Brilliant. Well, we've gone through all the questions. One final one at the end, in terms of sort of like your favorite sort of like stock idea for the next sort of 12 to 18 months. You were spot on last time. So no pressure now, Nick. What's your view?
Dear. Let me think. I mean, I would say again, I mean, genuinely, I think what I said Volex last time, and it must be up 40-50%. I would pick that again, purely because I think that the AI momentum is kind of completely overlooked by the market. I mean, there's obviously other kind of good things going on in that business as well. But you know, potentially, you know, consensus is too light. There's lots of margin upside baked in, which we're not quite seeing yet. So I would have thought that they will continue to do well over the next 12 months. And actually, you know, I'll go back to YouGov. I think YouGov has a lot of catalysts over the next 12 months. You know, again, that shopper business in Germany, they put up, you know, they potentially put a for sale sign on that business. You know, if they sold that at a good valuation, you know, they will de-gear this business. And, you know, behind that, you've got a core which is maybe kicking out 25 million of cash a year. So, you know, again, that would be a huge catalyst. But even if they keep it, I think there's still a lot going on there just with the self-help. So I'm going to say YouGov as well, as a kind of contentious view. But we'll see how that goes. I think they're going to do well.
Okay, good. I'll have a good look at that myself. So anyway, thanks very much, everyone, for your questions. Thanks, obviously, Nick, for your time. I'm sorry I've taken so much of it. It's 90 minutes, so it's been absolutely fascinating.
I've almost lost my voice.
So. I know. You've done absolutely brilliant. So we've got plenty of ideas that people can go through, and very much look forward in touching base again, probably the six to 12 months. So thanks, Nick.
Good. Thanks, Paul.